Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I'd like to welcome all of you to my program, the Michael Cutler Hour. For those of you who are familiar with me, you know that I spent about 30 years working for what used to be the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, spent half my career chasing drug dealers in concert with other law enforcement officers from just about everywhere and any place, whether it was the FBI, DEA, ATF, U.S. Customs, local state police, and foreign governments, the Israelis, the Canadians, the Brits, Japanese, and others. We all worked cooperatively together to combat the menace of narcotics trafficking, the crime, the violence that goes with it, the terrorists and, that they fund. And now that I've retired, my goal has been, ever since 9/11 in particular, to call attention to how the failures of the immigration system are affecting our country. You know, I think that immigration is not just a minor issue, but the most significant challenge that we face. It impacts everything, and I mean everything from national security and criminal justice to the economy, the environment, healthcare, education, community safety. You name the issue, it's probably getting hammered. And this isn't a statement of xenophobia. This isn't about racism or bigotry. The other side loves to say, well, if you want secure borders, then you must be a bigot, a racist, some evil sort of a character. Not at all. The point is that the immigration laws that were passed by Congress and the law that they enforce today, by the way, has its roots in the Immigration and Nationality Act that were enacted way back in 1952, believe it or not. And those laws were designed, simply stated, to protect American lives and American jobs. Yet today we have politicians and we have these brilliant political pundits who get on TV, especially on Sunday mornings. We've all seen them. And they say, well, you can't get the Latino vote if you don't come up with the DREAM Act. You can't get the Latino vote if you don't give a pathway to citizenship to illegal aliens. And I got to tell you, this is nonsense. It's not true. And we've got to be the Mythbusters because, let's face it, the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar, as I always like to say. And I can assure you that most people who are naturalized citizens, who are lawful immigrants, who have abided by the law and followed not only the letter of the law, but the color of the law, the intent of the law, are resentful of people who would jump the line, are resentful of people who have shown contempt for our nation's sovereign borders and contempt for our nation's laws that, again, are designed to protect us. These laws are not about keeping out people of a certain race or ethnicity or religion. If they were, I could never have enforced those laws. Those laws are designed to keep people out of our country who pose a threat to our safety and well-being. And while we hear all this talk about the need to create lots of jobs, you know, the president says, I'm going to create jobs, and Newt Gingrich says it, they all say it, we're going to create jobs. I mean, the only politicians that probably aren't talking about creating jobs are dog catchers, you know. Everybody says, I'm going to create a job. Well, let's give a little fundamental thought here. We have millions upon millions of illegal aliens. Officially, they acknowledge 11 million. I think that's another one of these wacky statements. We've been at 11 million forever. We're probably looking at maybe 30, 35 million. Who knows? Maybe 40 million. There is no way of knowing. And, you know, they try to figure out how many are here, they say, by how many are being arrested. Well, the Border Patrol has been intimidated into not making any arrests. Look at what just happened to Brian Terry a year ago. His family is suing the Justice Department over Fast and Furious. And they have every justification because that was the wacky program that put at least 2,000 high-powered, fully functioning weapons into the hands of the Mexican cartels. So we're being told, well, you know, we have all these aliens here. Well, guess what? If they are here illegally and working, the jobs they take are most certainly the jobs that Americans need. The jobs that Americans need to keep their homes from falling into foreclosure. The jobs that Americans need to be able to feed their children. According to ABC News, one in four American kids today in these United States is food insecure. Well, what does food insecure mean? Well, according to the report that was in ABC News just a couple of months ago, you are food insecure if you wake up in the morning not certain as to whether or not you will have three square meals to eat that day. This is America we're talking about, folks, not a third world country, but we are rapidly becoming a third world country. We have exported our factories, we have exported our jobs, and we continue to import foreign workers. whether it's illegal aliens at the bottom economic rung or the high-tech workers who are doing the works in factories, who are the computer programmers, the engineers, the scientists, the technicians. We are relegating American citizens to a situation that would have been unthinkable just a generation ago. And so with all of this going on, with the war on terror going on, and now ABC News is saying that there are great concerns that Iran may decide to attack the United States because they are upset about the sanctions. The sanctions, of course, having been implemented to try to stop their nuclear program, because it's believed by just about everybody, yours truly included, that they're not just looking to have nuclear reactors to generate electricity, but to be able to build nuclear weapons. These folks truly are loose cannons, and I speak specifically of Ahmadinejad, the leader of Iran. And what people need to understand is that right now, this moment, while you're listening to my voice, there are Iranian soldiers, what they call the Quds, they're shock troops stationed in increasing numbers in Venezuela. We know that there are terror training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil abuts with Argentina and Paraguay. But meanwhile, we have the President of the United States just about a week ago going to Disney World, of all places, saying that we should include Brazil on the list of countries whose citizens don't need visas to come to the United States. This is insanity. This is sheer insanity. And this isn't a conservative issue, again, the way the media would portray this. Oh, yes, you've got to be a right-wing nut if you want secure borders. You know, I've been registered as a Democrat my whole life. I will tell you, I don't know the last time I voted for a Democrat, because I don't think either party is really concerned about the average American. I think that more and more Americans are convinced of this. And that's why we've seen the polar opposites, the Tea Party and the occupiers. I certainly don't like the tactics used by the occupiers. I don't like the violence and all the stuff that goes with it. But I think at least initially the people who went down to Wall Street and elsewhere were fellow Americans who looked at the situation and said, this is out of control. If you look at the Tea Partiers, same deal, different side of the aisle. They're looking at it and saying, my gosh, what has happened to our country? How can we keep running up the deficits? How can we keep having open borders? How can we keep ignoring the demands, common sense demands of the average American, and still say that this is a government by the people, for the people, and of the people? It doesn't work. So in a couple of minutes, a gentleman who wrote a book, and in fact I met this guy when I had the great privilege, the great honor of speaking at the Tea Party Convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, just a couple of weeks ago. Dean Allen has written a book about the rattlesnake revolution. He will be joining me at about a quarter past the hour. And we're going to talk about the Tea Party. And we're going to talk about where America now stands, and we're going to talk about where America needs to go. You're certainly welcome to join the conversation. My phone number here is 310-982-4145. Again, write it down, folks, 310-982-4145. This is Mike Cutler speaking to you on my program, the Michael Cutler Hour, on Blog Talk Radio, on the USA Talk Radio Network. And it's a pleasure to be able to spend an hour with you at the end of every week to be able to provide my perspectives. You know, I've done a lot of TV and radio programs, but I'm always at the whim, at the mercy, if you will, of the producers of those programs, and I'm certainly thrilled when they call up and say, Mike, can you come down? In fact, yesterday I spent an hour on Curtis Sliwa's excellent radio program that he broadcasts from the Empire State Building in Midtown Manhattan. It was good to get together with Curtis. And Curtis had this great idea many, many years ago to form the Guardian Angels, a grassroots civilian effort to augment the police so that people would be more secure. And his idea was such a profound idea, it was such a great idea, that he has now gone international. There are Guardian Angels in different countries around the world. See, this idea that we're helpless and hopeless, that we're going to sit on our hands and that nothing is going to change and we can't make things change, that's wrong. And if you believe that I'm not right, well, then I got a bit of persuasion that may be able to help you a bit. Go to a park and see all those statues. And we all know the parks that have the statues, that man or woman on horseback. And why are they up there? Because at a moment in history, that person made all the difference in the world. We are living in a historic era, folks. I mean, every era is kind of historic. I remember when I was a kid back in high school, there was an evening program that came on. If I remember correctly, it was about 8 o'clock on Friday nights, and they would sum up the major news stories of the week. And the announcer would come on and he would intone, "History is the news that's worth remembering." And I remember this guy with his big, powerful voice saying that. History is the news that's worth remembering. Well, we certainly live in the historic era. There is much going on around the world, and not all the news is good news. And we, as Americans, need to take responsibility. We need to be the best citizens we could be. We need to be equal to the valor and the patriotism of our men and women in the armed forces. We need to be equal to our first responders, the law enforcement officers, the firefighters, the folks who go in harm's way as a matter of routine to protect our nation and protect our citizens. And, you know, that's why when I write commentaries, I always like to say that democracy is not a spectator sport, because it most certainly is not. And by the way, while we're talking about what you can do, the first step is to become educated in the issues. And a great way for you to become educated in the issues is to go to a couple of websites. If you're listening to my program, you're probably familiar with my website. That website is michaelcutler.net, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, michaelcutler.net. And I'm also very proud to be a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. They're based out of Santa Barbara, California. I had the great joy of being out there with them for a speaking engagement just about a week and a half ago. Great part of the country, nice warm weather. I never thought I could stroll through the streets with, in shirt sleeves in the middle of the night in January, but in Santa Barbara you can do that. So it was great visiting with them, having that speaking engagement, and then I did a follow-up speaking engagement in Ontario, California, for the Concerned Women of America and Act for America, because they had a panel discussion bringing in some experts, and of course my area of expertise is that of border security and the enforcement of the immigration laws. And you know, I want you to think about the immigration laws, but before I do that, I don't know if I had given you the CAPS website. It's capsweb.org, so please jot that down. I want to make certain that I don't let that slide by without giving it to you. The CAPS website, Californians Population Stabilization, is CAPS, C-A-P-S, web.org. One word, capsweb.org. The immigration laws and our borders really have to be seen as an adjunct to what the men and women of the military do. The whole point to having a military is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible. That's why we have the stealth bombers, the nuclear submarines. Goodness, we have so much in terms of manpower, women power as well, of course, and technology, and it's all devoted to protecting America. How can our military protect us, however, when we have open borders that enable people from all over the world to easily enter our country and set up shop in any American city that they want? You look at this threat being posed by Iran. You look at the fact that they do have their people right now in this hemisphere, undoubtedly in this country, and undoubtedly prepared to enter this country if hostilities were to break out between the United States and Iran. And if you don't think that this poses a clear and imminent danger to our well-being, then you better go and make sure you still have a pulse. You know, there are many Iranians who live here, by the way, and this is a very important distinction to make, who oppose what is going on in Iran. They are here because they've had it, because their lives were threatened, because they want freedom. And those people are people that are part of our community, and rightfully so. So we've got to be very careful that we draw clear distinctions. But I will tell you that the Iranian government is on the move. This is more than saber-rattling. They are determined to build intercontinental ballistic missiles. They are determined to build a nuclear device, and that's something we need to be mindful of. I think Dean Allen is here now. Let me see if this is our guest for today. Dean, is that you?
It's me, Michael. How's everything in New York?
Everything in New York is peachy keen, as you would probably say down south where you come from. It was in the 40s today, nearly 60 yesterday. Probably not as cool as it is where you are, though. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Greenville, South Carolina.
Wow, that's a beautiful part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you for joining me. Why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about your background, and then we'll get right to the book that you wrote. And I have a bunch of questions about why you went and wrote that book. So why don't you start out by telling everybody a little bit about your background and how you came to become part of the Tea Party.
Well, my background is I've been a political activist for nearly 50 years. I'm an old guy now at 61, and I used to be the youth chairman for Barry Goldwater in Galveston County, Texas, in 1964. I ran Ronald Reagan's Get Out the Vote operation there in 1980. Nixon and Eisenhower both carried Texas twice. Neither one of them ever carried Galveston County because it was a labor union stronghold, and we built a good organization down there and carried it for Ronald Reagan and helped make him president. I'm a Vietnam veteran, a businessman, and went to D.C. like a million plus of the rest of us back in September of 2009. And after we got back, I got to know a lot of the people that went up and back on the buses. We had about eight or nine bus loads from Greenville County here. People were saying, you got a lot of background in politics and so forth, go start a Tea Party. I said, look around. There's 50 of them in this state. They said, well, and 49 other states. They said, well, get all the leaders together and form them into one big, strong national organization. I said, it don't work that way. They don't think that way. You try that, you're going to step on a bunch of toes, and people are going to say you're trying to hijack their movement. So what I wrote the book for was just to give them some tools, some background, some historical perspective, and some guidance on how to become better organized and more effective at doing what they're already doing, where they're already doing, with the leaders they're working with. And it's my little contribution to help save the country.
Well, it's a heck of a background. And, you know, politically, we may not agree on certain issues. And as Americans, you know, that is our constitutional right. That's what I always tell people. We're supposed to have those conversations. You know, the First Amendment talks about the right to peaceably assemble, so we can have that conversation. But I think you and I will agree that the mainstream political parties, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, have all but ignored mainstream America. Would you disagree with me on that one, or would you agree with me?
Well, I hope some of my good long-time Republican friends have got their fingers in their ears, but the problem is the Democrat Party is for a collection of left-wing weirdos, and the Republican Party is for a bunch of people richer than Mitt Romney, and there isn't any political party for those of us that don't fall in one of those two categories. So every 4 years, both sides lie to us to get some votes out of the middle and get a majority together, and that's what's gone on forever in this country.
Well, I got to tell you, I could not agree with you more. You know, and I think that what we see the country do is stagger all the way to the right, all the way to the left, depending on which party holds sway. But I think the average American fundamentally wants the bus to stay on the highway. We may argue about what lane to drive in, but I don't think we want to drive it down the embankment, as some of the right-wing Looney Tunes want to do, or drive it over the guardrail, as the left-wing nuts want to do. I think most Americans tend to be more or less centrists with certain disagreements. What do you think of that assessment?
I think two things. There are a lot of problems that can be solved better in the private sector than by government, and some people have gotten addicted to looking for a government solution, and sometimes turning it over to the government is not the best solution, whether the government's being ran by Democrats or Republicans. The other thing is people want strong leadership and clear answers, somebody that can solve a problem and make something happen. Lots and lots of people that should have known better voted for Mr. Obama for one simple reason. He promised them hope and change. He said, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to fix problems and I'm going to make things better. Country's gotten on the wrong track, and it absolutely had in the last couple of years of the Bush administration. I'm going to make it better. And on that basis, a lot of people took him at his word and voted for him. Unfortunately, he was one of those political ideologues that's run us off in the ditch on the left side. And so I don't think some of those people are going to go with him this year.
No, I think, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I think a lot of people are coming to the realization that this administration is going kind of like Star Trek, going places no one's ever been before or wants to be. But
Obama and that little crowd of people around him are ideological true believers, and they're hardcore leftists, and they have a philosophy and they have an idea in their mind. If we do something like dump $786 billion worth of stimulus money into giving it to our friends and our labor union buddies, that's going to magically make the country better and put everybody back to work. Well, you know, might have been a great idea, but it absolutely didn't work. It run us further in the ditch. And they're not willing to recognize that it hasn't worked and make a correction and come back to the middle. They're saying, okay, borrow some more money from Red China and give us an even bigger stimulus and run the deficits through the roof some further. And it's got to work sooner or later because we just believe in it, you know, but it's not working.
Well, you said you were in business. What kind of business were you in when you came back from Vietnam?
Well, I've worked in the oil and gas business. I've been on offshore rigs from the Gulf of Mexico to Africa. Mm-hmm. And then I guess about 1980-ish, I got into doing tax and financial planning and asset protection for small business people. And I've traveled all through Latin America and the Caribbean and set up corporations and trusts and bank accounts for business people. And I did well in that for nearly 30 years. But after 9/11, all the my clients got paranoid that the government was going to think they were funding terrorism if they had an offshore corporation. So that business kind of died out, and I've gotten more and more into political consulting, worked on some presidential and some congressional campaigns as a staffer and a strategist and raised money. And now I'm kind of writing, you know, you get older. Sometimes that's a way you can have an influence, and you don't have to. I can't run up 17 flights of stairs on an offshore oil rig. It tears my knees up.
Sounds familiar. By the way, I've got you by about 3 years. You're younger than I am. And, you know, my days of chasing bad guys, same deal. Those are in my rearview mirror. But what do you think about the that oil pipeline or the gas pipeline that the Obama administration just knocked out once again? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's another one of these situations where his ideology and his inclination to help his friends that are far left environmentalists and unions overcomes his common sense of what would be good for the economy. The Canadians have a resource there in oil. It's sort of common sense to build a pipeline down to Texas, refine it into a product we can use, give us some independence from people that don't love us on the other side of the world, and create a lot of good-paying permanent jobs here. Like I said, I worked a lot of years in that industry.
Well, that's the reason I'm asking the question, Dean. So explain to me, because maybe I'm missing something. I heard Boehner say that this is about jobs, but isn't it also about national security? If you look at the situation in Iran, they're threatening to sink a ship in the Straits of Hormuz to block off the flow of oil to the United States, wouldn't it make sense to want to have that alternative source of energy for this country? Why is even on the Republican side, why aren't they talking about the strategy of this?
It not only makes sense, if we listen to Mr. Obama and refuse to build the pipeline south to Texas, what the Canadians are going to do is build a pipeline west and sell that oil to the Chinese. So the oil's going to be produced anyway. We're not stopping oil production.
Right.
And they're going to build that line over the Rocky Mountains in Canada, which would have a lot more environmental downsides and potential risk for falls. And I've worked for companies that do environmental cleanup. I went in as a superintendent in 2010 when they had that million-gallon spill in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and stayed up there 39 days cleaning it up. And it makes much more sense to come straight south out of Canada without having to go through the Rocky Mountains and some other things. You can engineer a safe pipeline with less risk of problems. And the world needs the oil. The Canadians are going to sell it to somebody. We're the logical recipients. We've got oil in our own country, and we've got oil offshore. I understand that the Chinese are drilling a major field 60 miles off of Florida right now, working with some Cuban companies. So that oil is going to be produced in the Gulf, whether or not the federal government of the United States lets Americans and our allies produce it so we can use it and make jobs for people here. It'll just go to the Red Chinese, and we'll be paying more to import stuff from the Middle East. You know, not exactly smart thinking.
No, I tend to agree with you on this, Dean. I'm just curious why Mr. Boehner didn't talk about the national security implications. Every time that he has spoken about it, he simply, you know, tied it to jobs. Jobs certainly are critically important, but I tie it to lots more than jobs. Am I getting that wrong?
You know, I've been a lifelong Republican, again, going back to Goldwater. But
by the way, you should be interested to know that one of my good friends now is Don Goldwater, who ran for governor, fortunately and successfully, Arizona, one of Goldwater's nephews.
Okay.
And I think he would have taken us in a very different direction, and I think he was a very interesting leader, Goldwater was.
Yeah, actually, Barry Goldwater would have started the Reagan Revolution in 1964. We had an anomalous situation. You know, President Kennedy got killed, and then you had sympathy for him, justifiably, based on here's a nice young man that got killed doing his job. And so there was all this emotionalism in the 64 election, and there was a Democrat landslide that year.
Yeah.
But if John F. Kennedy had been alive and having to defend his policies that were about as failed as Obama's, he was messing up the Vietnam War, he was messing up the Bay of Pigs, he was messing up the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he basically backed down to Castro and agreed to leave him in power, backed down to Khrushchev and agreed to leave Castro in power, and agreed to take American short-range missiles out of Turkey without getting much quid pro quo out of the Russians. And you had race riots starting up and a whole lot of things. And I think John Kennedy would have had a really tough time getting reelected in 1964 if he was alive and in good health and had to run on his record. And Barry Goldwater was talking about common sense, free market economics, and putting the country back in the right direction. But because it was an anomalous year, there was a lot of sympathy with Kennedy being killed, and I don't want to see anybody killed. I've had some of my knucklehead friends say bad illegal things ought to happen to Obama. I said, no, wait a minute, you know, that's bull. We don't do that in this country. And
no, that's
the
right.
Only thing I want to happen to Obama is I want him to get voted out of office so I don't have to buy the airplane gas for his airplane anymore.
No,
I'd
like to see him on the
air. But I don't want anybody to harm him in any way.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, that's so sad. I mean, we have become such a divided nation. And that's what I really find so disturbing. I agree with you completely. And when you hear this talk of this extreme anger and leading toward this idea of violence being acceptable, that's not the American way.
Exactly. That's something we've lost in this country, you know. You said earlier you and I may not agree. I've got friends that are liberal Democrats, and we don't agree at all on politics.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean you can't have a certain amount of civility. You know, we have dinner together. My wife loves ballroom dancing, and probably a third of the people we socialize with are what I call liberals.
Okay.
But we don't get at one another's throat, and sometimes
we're not supposed
to.
Politics
and social gatherings.
And you know what? We're not always right either. Sometimes I look back at a position I may have held on an issue, and a couple of years later, you know, time gives you a different perspective, and you think, well, gee whiz, maybe I got that issue wrong. So, you know, this is a learning process, I think, for all of us, and I think you would agree with me on that one, wouldn't you, Dean?
Oh, yeah. Here in the South, you know, we had to do a bunch of learning on race relations.
Yep.
I don't like that sometimes the pendulum swings too far the other way and they call it affirmative action and discriminate against me, but that doesn't make discrimination against anybody right, and we clearly discriminated against black people years ago, and that was a mistake, you know? So, yeah, the country grows and corrects its errors, but if we can talk to each other and listen to ideas and look at what works and what doesn't work, that collective wisdom out there, the people may make a mistake, but they will recognize and come back and correct that mistake. And people are getting the idea that the system is broken down and they want to reinvent the wheel, create minor political parties or turn to violence, and none of that stuff, none of the above is going to fix the country. We're going to have to go back to being educated and being effective and working to get results produced. And unfortunately, Boehner and a lot of my Republican friends over the years, they write beautiful platforms, make great speeches, and they haven't stood up and laid out a clear alternative to what the left has done. And I think if they had done that, we'd have had more support and the voters would have been given a clear choice.
Well, that always seems to be the problem. But don't you find that most politicians are so busy pandering to the crowd, they probably get before they get up on stage, they'll turn to their staffer and say, well, what is it that these folks expect to hear from me, rather than how do I convince them that I'm right?
That's my frustration with Mitt Romney. You know, the guy looks good, his hair's combed, his family looks good, he says the right words, but I don't feel any fire in the belly. You know, it's like the focus group told him what he believes deep down in his heart, and his consultants wrote his speech for him, and somebody picked out the necktie he's wearing, and I just don't have this feeling that the guy's really got something down inside him that tells him what he believes in, and he's going to get the bull by the horns, so to speak, and go do something because he knows he can do it. He's saying words to us, and, you know, we miss Ronald Reagan, and he's not, you know, we all remember Ronald Reagan grabbing that microphone in New Hampshire and saying, damn it, I paid for this, you know. I haven't seen that kind of fire in this little crowd that's there. You get it once in a while out of Ron Paul, and of course, everybody knows the problem. We're fixing to get rocks thrown at us when I say something evil about Ron Paul, but he's a genius on economics and he's a ding-a-ling on foreign policy.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he really. Well, you know, I was at the debate and it was an interesting experience. And sometimes, you know, you'd say, okay, he's making sense, and then he would kind of veer, at least to my thinking, would veer off the road.
Yeah,
so it was an interesting experience.
But he's the only one I see up there that's got any fire in the belly, you know. He's a true believer like Obama. You know, I got this philosophy. I got something I believe in. I'm on a mission from God. I'm wound up, fired up, and if you turn me loose, I'm fixing to go kick somebody, you know. And
I wish
Mitt Romney had a little bit of that kind of energy in him, you know. Newt tends to have a lot more of it. Newt's just, he's another mixed bag. He's got brilliant ideas and done great things, and then every once in a while he gets off the reservation.
Yeah, they all seem to get off the reservation before too very long, don't they?
Uh-huh.
So in your book, basically, how would you break down what you wrote about? Why don't you give us an idea about that?
Well, I started out with kind of a history lesson. I wrote it about and to Tea Party people. So I started with the original Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party in 1773, talked about it. It's a fascinating historical incident, and I've got an opening chapter that gives you some interesting things about the people who were involved and what actually happened and the purposes. All the Tea Party people loved to get together and argue and squabble and point fingers, and every one of them claimed they started it and somebody else hijacked it. So I pointed out to them the first modern usage of Tea Party as a metaphor for a political protest started in the 1970s, and it was primarily from an old lawyer by the name of Robert Clarkson down in Anderson, South Carolina, who was organizing tax protesters in the 70s, and they called their activities Tea Parties. And, you know, you Google that or dig into the newspaper files.
Well, you guys in South Carolina are always getting in the middle of this, aren't you?
Yeah, Robert Clarkson was Tea Partying for 30 years before all these people in February of 2009 decided to suddenly do it. And then the other thing I do in the book, I relate it to the historical context. If you look at the history of America, we've had many grave problems face us down through the centuries. Whether it was slavery or prohibition or women's suffrage or civil rights or labor relations or whatever, and you have some terrible problem or injustice, you have protests that happen over the injustice of what's going on. Those protests coalesce into organizations. Those organizations learn to become politically effective and win elections. Those elected people pass legislation to correct the problem that started that thing going, and in the course of all this happening, we change the consciousness of the American people and how our culture relates to something, and we get from where slavery is acceptable to Thomas Jefferson, who's writing all that good stuff in the Declaration of Independence, to where it's not acceptable to us anymore, and so on and so forth. Well, the Tea Party movement is another major social and political movement that is changing the country and responding to something terrible. In this case, we're drowning in a sea of red ink. We're spending money we don't have and borrowing 40 cents of every dollar we spend and throwing away money with both hands and saddling our grandchildren and their grandchildren with debts that can't be paid. And that's not a sustainable solution to problems. We've got to get back to fiscal sanity.
Right.
So the Tea Party went through the same growing pains and evolutionary process that the anti-slavery people, that the women's suffrage people, that the prohibitionists, that the organized labor movement did. And we were talking about avoiding violence and having civil discourse. Labor and civil rights in particular would have been able to correct legitimate problems decades earlier if they hadn't been heavily infiltrated by communists inciting violence. Because a lot of people would look out and say, you know, we don't want coal miners dying because the mine owners are too tight to spend money on safety. And again, we don't want black people being slaves and victims of all sorts of legitimate crime. But we didn't like a lot of the communists infiltrating some of these organizations and inciting people to violence as a response to these things. Violence was not the response that fixed it. Changing the consciousness of the American people and getting legislation in place is what fixes problems. So I want my friends in the Tea Party to understand violence doesn't work. I got a chapter where I talk about minor political parties. All they do is elect the major party that's most dissimilar to them. You can look, Theodore Roosevelt, 1912, elected Woodrow Wilson.
And, yeah, because they divide the vote.
Ross Perot elected Bill Clinton, and minor parties on the left, Ralph Nader running on the Green Party in Florida, took enough votes away from Al Gore to give the state of Florida to George Bush. And if Ralph Nader hadn't been on the ballot, you would have had Al Gore for president instead of George Bush. So minor parties don't win. No minor party has ever won. And misinformed people come up and say, well, the Republican Party at one time was a third party. No, it wasn't. What happened, the Whig Party went through a dissolution and reorganization and renaming process in about 1850, and they began calling themselves Republicans instead of Whigs. But except for the last 9 years of his life, Abe Lincoln was a Whig all his life, and the Whig Party had three major tenets. They believed in tariffs on imports, they believed in paper money and central banks, and they believed in what they called internal improvements. Today we would call it public works or government stimulus. And it was those three things that were the historical roots of the Whig Party, and that's what the Republican Party under Lincoln was, and for many years after the war between the states. So they were never really a minor party. They were a continuation of the Whigs that no longer existed.
Fascinating. But they almost sound like the Democratic agenda of today.
Well, if I get around to writing another book, I'm going to talk about how between 1860 and 1980, the Democrat and Republican parties changed about 180 degrees and changed places with each other philosophically.
It does sound like a square dance, doesn't it? They did a little do-si-do, huh?
I think that would have actually happened in the late 40s or early 50s, or by 60 at the latest, except, again, the minor party influence. When Strom Thurmond here in South Carolina walked out of the 48th Democrat Convention and formed the States Rights Democrat Party that they called Dixiecrats, carried 39 electoral votes, what he basically did was let all the disgruntled conservatives in the Democrat Party not gravitate to the Republicans in 1948 and reelected Harry Truman, whose policies he didn't like. And then the same thing happened later on. You know, you would have had realignments in the 50s or 60s. And when Ronald Reagan came along, he gave them permission to call themselves Reagan Democrats. So now they could vote Republican and still pretend they were Democrats. And 40 years later, we're getting into the second and third generation of Reagan Democrats. Some of these Reagan Democrats have never voted Democrat and never will. And Ronald Reagan finally allowed the realignment on ideological basis of the two political parties.
Interesting background. Very thought-provoking, I got to tell you. Your book is available, I guess, on Amazon, is that right?
It is, and I've also got a website, rattlesnakerevolution.com, and I've also got I've got the paperback book that's 294 pages, but I've also got the e-book that they can download for their Kindle and Nook, and I like my Nook. I'm a Barnes & Noble guy.
Okay.
So,
how did you come up with Rattlesnake Revolution? That's an interesting title.
Well, I was writing about the Tea Party, and I started out to put the Gadsden flag, that's the yellow flag with the coiled rattlesnake that says, "Don't tread on me."
Uh-huh.
That was one of the ones that was a favorite of patriots in the Revolution. And, you know, most of the Tea Party's kind of adopted that as an unofficial symbol, I guess, and you saw lots of those things at the Tea Parties in 09. And I was going to just put one of those flags on the cover of the book. And we looked at it and looked at it, and that rattlesnake on the Gadsden flag looks like it was drawn by a third grader that didn't have much artistic talent in 1776, you know. And I said, well, I'm going to take that flag off, and I'm just going to find a picture of a real rattlesnake and put it on there, which I did. Go to the website. I got a fine rattlesnake on there. So that was just kind of hit me as what we had with the Tea Parties was basically another revolution, a nonviolent revolution, but a revolution that we're going to take the country back, and that rattlesnake was the symbol. So instead of using the Gadsden flag, I just came up with that.
That's very interesting. You know, it's remarkable that so many politicians, and I think it's wishful thinking on their part, and I'm sure you're going to agree with me on this one, oh, the Tea Party is passe, they're done, they had their moment, and it's over. I don't see it that way. I'm sure you don't either.
Well, in 2010, we did a pretty remarkable thing. We replaced more than 80 members of Congress, and we dramatically switched the majority from Democrats to Republicans, which meant that Nancy Pelosi would no longer be Speaker. And the liberal talking heads say, yeah, but you lost the Senate, you know, and they want to blame that on the Tea Party. You know, Republicans could have picked up the Senate, too, in 2010, but the Tea Party people screwed it up by being too radical. I'm sorry, that's a bunch of horse crap. The Senate elections, we
Dean,
lost.
Why don't you tell me what you really think?
Well, we lost an election in Delaware because the girl who was running went out to campaign to Christian fundamentalists and told them she used to dabble in witchcraft. And
oh,
we
boy.
Lost a Senate seat in
right.
California because there's about three times as many Democrats as Republicans in California now, and it's going to be tough to run statewide in California anymore as a Republican until the demographics change. And we picked up seats like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and people. So I think the Tea Party did a remarkable thing on the House side, and we made great progress on the Senate side, and the losses couldn't be blamed legitimately on the Tea Party. If they simply stay focused, continue to do what they did so well in 2010, we can pick up control of the Senate, but the key factor is this, and here's where I'm hopeful and optimistic for the Tea Party. The goal is not just to move the Senate and the White House from Democrat to Republican, because Newt did that in 94, and all those people elected with an R after their name then went out and raised taxes and spent money just like the Democrats had and frustrated people. And if we don't just want Republicans, we want people that follow the Constitution and free enterprise and sound financial policies. And the Tea Party is going to need to be there to hold a feet to the fire on these Republicans. The Republican Party platform is a wonderful thing. I put it up there beside the Constitution and the King James Bible. But we got a whole lot of people in public office with an R after their name, and sometimes Speaker John Boehner, who don't always do what that platform says our goals are. They want to make deals and run as socialism light. Not only is it not good political strategy, we're electing these people to straighten up the mess in the country, and when they win, we expect them to go do that. We don't want to hear about excuses and compromises.
The one thing that I would disagree with you about, this might be interesting, when you speak about the free enterprise part, I worry about globalism. Now, how do you differentiate your perspective from globalism?
I think we're in a world today, if you look at transportation and communication and financial ability to move money with technology,
right,
we do have a global integrated economy. And I'll give you one example here. Our tax system has gotten where we tax people too much for being successful. And as a result, a lot of people who are successful and have excess money, instead of putting that money at risk and creating jobs and having the economy move, they park that money offshore where they're not going to be taxed on it, and they outsource their labor if they're in an industry where they can do that to other places. So we need to recognize a capital gains tax. You're taxing people on money that they've already paid taxes on once, and you're penalizing them for putting it at risk and hiring people and creating jobs and trying to do something. If we got the capital gains tax down to zero, there's $5 or $6 trillion of American-owned corporate money that's being held outside the United States, and those people would love to come back and put it to work here. But because they've got fear over regulatory uncertainty and because they've got tax burdens and people wanting to raise them higher, they're not willing to bring that money back in and put it to work. And, governments spending $786 billion did nothing. That went to people who look like Mr. Obama and people who were part of labor unions that supported his political machine, and it didn't do anything to stimulate the economy. There's not a shortage of money. There's plenty of money to be put into business. The people that have it aren't willing to risk it because of taxes and regulatory burdens. And, you can't just put a tariff at the water's edge and say that's going to stimulate
industrial
production in America.
Would you oppose a tariff as part of an overall strategy?
I tell you what I'd like to see. I would like to see us negotiate in good faith with other countries. And, when we did some of these GATT agreements and got tariffs down and we agreed to take off import tariffs and the French agreed to do the same thing, as they were phasing out the tariff under the treaty we negotiated, they were simultaneously increasing their VAT tax. And the net result was we were paying them the same rate of tax as we always were, but we were charging them less to bring products in here and putting Americans at a competitive disadvantage.
Right.
And I'd like to see our tax laws mirror those of every other country that we do business with. If you're going to impose tariffs, we'll impose tariffs, and we'd really like to have all sides drop them, but we don't need to drop ours unilaterally if they don't open markets to us. And, that's one thing that Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney both seem to talk about and be correct. We need a tougher strategy for dealing with the economy is integrated worldwide. You can like it or not, but that's a fact we have to live with. Let's survive, thrive, and prosper in that environment.
Well, my signature issue is this whole idea about bringing in foreign workers. And, that needs to be adjusted for also. I find it amazing that, we have India, the president of India complaining, or the prime minister of India complaining, we're charging too much for the H-1B visa application because they want to send us ever more of their employees. It's hard to give kids an incentive to get degrees in engineering, computer programming, and the sciences if you're going to bring in foreign workers who will work for $40,000 a year, don't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I got nothing against anybody anywhere else in the world, but unless you come to this country to become an American, speak English, and assimilate, and make this your country, we really don't need you. You're welcome to visit or go to school and go home or whatever you need to do, but, they talk about us being a nation of immigrants. We are, but those immigrants came here from everywhere in the world, to become Americans and speak English and fit into the culture, not to be in little hyphenated enclaves and not to send money to India or Mexico or wherever.
We're losing probably a couple hundred billion dollars a year to the money that's sent out of our country by foreign workers. How crazy is that?
Mm-hmm. I understand the second largest item in the Mexican economy right after oil production is money that illegal aliens in the U.S. send back to relatives in Mexico.
Yep, and you know, it's funny. I was on Fox and Friends a year ago this past August. I remember it because I had said something that really seemed to have struck with them. They were talking about the lawsuit against Arizona. And, you know, I worked with the law firm that Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, retained to defend them against the lawsuit filed by the Justice Department for daring to promulgate their own immigration laws to fill the federal government's vacuum that they created. And then we got into a discussion about Calderon, and I said, you know, he came to the United States, he went before a joint session of Congress, and there were actually members of Congress who stood up and gave him a standing ovation. And I said, you know, anybody who thought that Felipe Calderon was entitled to a standing ovation would probably say that the person that puts cheese on a mousetrap is simply trying to feed hungry mice. So
that's a pretty good idea, Michael.
I thought you might like that one, Dean.
I know your background is in immigration and related things, and that you've got years and years of service to the country and a lot of expertise. Something occurs to me. Everybody talks about using E-Verify to verify that people are here legally and have a Social Security number when you hire them. How about if we required them at Western Union when they want to send money to Mexico to verify that this person is in the United States legally and earned that money legally? And if they didn't, and you're letting Western Union facilitate them in committing a federal crime and send the proceeds of that money on, why don't we do a RICO thing and shut down Western Union until they can verify? You know, I mean, is that unworkable?
I'll tell you a funny story about Western Union. There's a guy by the name of Charlie Foate, who at the time, and this was when Tom Tancredo was a member of Congress, he was the head of the Immigration Reform Caucus. And, you know, I testified for Tom about 5 weeks after 9/11 without permission. And the next day, I got an overnight package in the mail. I think smoke was pouring out of the envelope, as I recall, telling me I was no longer an agent. I was home with an injured leg, but we all know why they wanted me out. It was because I dared testify without authority. But Tom went after Western Union and went after all those remittances, and he proposed that any money wired out of the country should be taxed. So Charlie Foate, who was the head of First Data Corp, which was the parent of Western Union, moved the company from Atlanta, Georgia, to Denver. I think it was Denver, Colorado, or Boulder. I'm pretty sure it's Denver. And I guess he was watching The Godfather, where they said, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And he created a PAC to try to unseat Tancredo, because he was livid that they would actually want to tax the money. Do you know that they make over a billion? I forgot what the exact number is, but it's well over $1 billion a year in the fees that they charge to wire the money out of the United States. So if you look at the way this is all being done, I don't know if they're still doing it, but I know the Bank of America had a program called SafeSend, where they advertised on TV that this was a safe and secure means of moving money from the United States to Mexico with, quote-unquote, a minimum of human intervention. So I called up a good friend, Jerry Sieper, who was a reporter at the Washington Times. He did a story about it. The commercials immediately stopped, and they took this big thing off their homepage about SafeSend, and there was just a little button you could click on, and it would take you to the website. The movement of money out of the United States not only enriches the economies of the receiving countries, but it also generates lots of monies for the banks, for the Western Union folks. And what's really remarkable, the World Bank has written studies about this. America, I believe last year, 49% of the remittances that went to the third world came from the United States, 49%. And they were bragging at the UN of what a wonderful form of foreign aid this is, because nobody could mess with it. The people come here, they do their thing, and they siphon the money out of our economy, and it goes right into the economies of the third world countries, and isn't that a wonderful thing? And I have to tell you, I thought I was going to need an air sickness bag when I read that report.
Yeah.
I mean, is that remarkable or is that remarkable?
When I was talking about tariff laws needed to mirror the laws of other countries, I'm sure you're familiar what the immigration laws are down in Mexico.
Oh, absolutely.
Mexico,
and by the way, do you know
they built,
I just wanted to tell you, they built a fence to make sure that people from Central America don't make their way into Mexico from Guatemala, El Salvador. And I have a theory. You know what my theory is? They don't want illegal aliens from those countries making their way to Mexico and into the United States where they will compete with Mexican illegal aliens.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, they have very strict laws, and if I went down to Mexico and burned a Mexican flag and marched in the street and demanded rights and benefits from the Mexican government and generally showed my butt while I was there illegally, as a bare minimum, they would lock me up and they might kill me and they'd probably whip my behind while they locked me up.
You'd be the man who never returned.
I understand some of those prisons they throw you in down there. If your family don't bring you food, they let you starve to death.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't want the illegal alien that's up here mistreated in any way. Most of them were looking for economic opportunity. But I do think it's time we picked them up and sent them home, you know, and we can explain to them in Spanish they broke the law and they're going home now.
Well, they do that. All the paperwork is done in the native language of the alien that we arrest. And even if we don't deport everybody, if you deprive them the opportunity to get driver's licenses, or jobs, or open bank accounts. It's kind of like going to a restaurant and the chef comes out and says, folks, we've run out of food. How long would you sit there?
Yeah, exactly.
Why don't you put your website out there? We're getting close to the top of the hour. And I got to tell you, it was a fascinating hour. It went very, very quickly. I appreciate you joining me tonight, Dean.
I've enjoyed it, and I hope that you've got a big listening audience and we get a little participation and motivate them to do something. My website's rattlesnakerevolution.com, so go to the website and order the book, and send me an email and link me to this Blog Talk Radio. I know you archive these, and I'll put a link to it on my website for you.
That's wonderful. I certainly appreciate it, and I hope you stay in touch. I wish you good luck with the book. I hope you do another one. You're an interesting guy. It was great meeting you down in your stomping grounds in South Carolina. I have to tell you, it's a beautiful part of the country.
Yeah, I enjoyed meeting you. Tom Tancredo was at that same conference. I don't know if you saw him. I got to talk to him and shake his hand.
No, I missed bumping into Tom. He always jokes. He says, I'm the only guy that he's ever gotten fired who still talks to him.
Actually, you were at the Tea Party conference in Myrtle Beach. I saw Tom 3 or 4 days later in Charleston. At the Southern
no, that's right. No, I wasn't in Charleston. I was in Myrtle Beach.
Yeah, I saw Tom at the conference in Charleston. That's where that was. But
gotcha.
Yes, sir, I've enjoyed talking to you. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the program, and let's definitely stay in touch, and thank you for what you're doing to call attention to some of this stuff.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your hard work as well, and tell your friends down in South Carolina I send my best regards, and I hope to see you all before too very long.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. Good night.
Thanks for being on the program. Folks, that was Dean, and you know, I have to tell you, the book sounds like it should be fascinating. Go to his website, rattlesnakerevolution.com. And while we're talking about websites, I'm going to remind you that I have a website as well, and that's michaelcutler.net. And I'd also urge you to go to capsweb.org. We're doing some pretty good work down in California, but you know, it's not just about California, because the immigration crisis impacts every single country. And I want to be clear about something. You know, when we have certain politicians, I know Mr. Huntsman, who was running initially for president, said, well, if I get elected, I'm going to get with the governors of the 4 border states. Folks, we don't have 4 border states. We have 50 border states. Any state that has an international airport or a seaport is as much a border state as are those states to be found along the Mexican or the Canadian borders. And it was interesting that Mr. Huntsman didn't even pay any attention to the Canadian border. Immigration is a system. It's not just about the borders. It's about the way that we naturalize people. It's the way that we grant visas or expand the visa waiver program. It's about the movement of people into our country. And in a perilous era, we would do well to be careful that we don't let people in who would do harm to us. This isn't about xenophobia. It's not about bigotry. It's about common sense. We all have peepholes and doorbells or a door knocker or some other signaling device so that we can determine who to let into our homes to try to keep people out of our homes who would do harm to us. Essentially, that's why we have immigration laws. They are vital, and it's important that we, the people, make our voices heard to the politicians who so much want to be reelected or are seeking office for the first time. If they're out there on the campaign trail, then I urge you to go to those town hall meetings. I urge you to get your voice heard. I urge you to ask the tough questions and to learn the way that we are being deceived most of the time. You know, I've jokingly said that the ideal candidate for probably any office would be David Copperfield, because then at least you would get a professional illusionist. And unfortunately, all too often, the people who run for public office, and certainly there are some notable exceptions, people like Steve King and Lou Barletta and Jeff Sessions, and I could name several others. Chuck Grassley has been doing yeoman service to our country, going after Fast and Furious, going after other issues that are of great importance. Daryl Issa is doing a great job with Fast and Furious. But so many politicians really are illusionists. They get in front of that audience, and they try to take positions that are so vague that people on both sides of the same argument think that they heard what they wanted to hear when these guys get done speaking. This isn't about leadership. It's about pandering. It's about making sure they get elected, and then you have to wonder sometimes, well, why did they bother if they're not really going to address the critically important issues of the day that are so important to all Americans, so important to our country, so important to our survival, our economy, community safety. Everything is getting hammered because of this nonsense. So we, the people, have got to be the best citizens that we could be. And that's why I always like to end commentaries by saying democracy is not a spectator sport. Please bear those words in mind. Think of the way that we go to a restaurant and we're very specific about the food that we eat, the way we want it prepared, how we order it. We don't say to some waiter, throw some stuff on the plate, I'll eat it. Well, if we don't make our demands, our desires, our concerns known to the political folks who are paid to represent us in a manner of speaking, that's precisely what we're doing. We're encouraging them to throw some stuff on the plate, and we'll eat whatever it is. That has to stop. We live in a dangerous era, and we really need to take our responsibilities as citizens seriously. I want to thank all of you for spending this past hour and a couple of minutes with me on my program. I hope that you will be joining me again next week, next Friday, same time. Please go to my website, michaelcutler.net, capsweb.org. And again, folks, I would like to remind you, democracy is not a spectator sport. Thank you so much for joining me. See you next week, everybody. Good night. Have a great weekend.